Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Historian Larry Schmidt from the Big Blue Interactive and Gridiron Uniform Database websites joins us once again to talk about the NYC area teams of the AAFC, the New York Yankees and the Brooklyn Dodgers football franchises, and we'll hear their history and more with Larry Schmidt in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron, one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And we are going to continue into our look into the All-America Football Conference. We have two teams left that we have not yet talked about, and we are going to bring in our expert on these two. It's our friend Larry Schmidt. You've heard him before here on Pigskin Dispatch. You've also seen his work on Big Blue Interactive and on the Gridiron Uniform Database. And he is who we go to when we want to talk about football in New York City and in the surrounding area. And Larry Schmidt, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Thanks for having me, Darren.
Now, Larry, we got two teams left, and they're up from your neck of the woods, where it's your specialty that you just love to do the archaeology on those teams. And why don't you tell us about who you're going to be talking about tonight?
Sure. And, you know, and some of these teams, it really is archaeology, because it's really hard to dig up information, because a lot of these teams are just, they're long forgotten, which we talked about. You know, the last time I was on with the lineage of the Colts and all these teams called the Yankees. And, you know, a lot of these teams are just faded into obscurity. But we are going to talk about, from the All-America Conference, the Brooklyn Dodgers, not of the NFL Brooklyn Dodgers lineage, and the All-America Conference New York Yankees, who are of the NFL Brooklyn Dodgers lineage, which we talked about in detail last time. And we know it gets confusing, so, you know, maybe look up that past episode. But, you know, we're going to touch on a couple of these teams again tonight.
Yeah. And, you know, listeners, we are talking football, not the Brooklyn Dodgers and New York Yankees of baseball, of Major League Baseball. These are football teams that were named on a coattails of those two great baseball organizations to help get some fans in the stands, I believe is why they did it. Is that correct, Larry?
Yeah, it was very common for the when a football team played in a baseball stadium, they would take the name of the baseball team, which the football Giants played in the Polo Grounds with the baseball Giants. And we had several teams playing Yankee Stadium, call themselves the Yankees, and a couple of teams played in Ebbets Field, called themselves the Dodgers. And it was just common practice. You know, in Chicago, the Bears played in Cubs Park with the Cubs, and they just, you know, football players are bigger than baseball players, so they took the name the Bears, and it was not uncommon at all.
Okay. So
and the Washington Redskins were originally the Boston Braves, because they played in the same park with the Boston Braves.
And the Pittsburgh Steelers were once the Pittsburgh Pirates.
With the Pittsburgh Pirates. So it's not unusual. It is confusing, but it wasn't unusual. It happened quite a bit back then.
Now, is that also the case? I mean, the listeners can't see it, but behind you, you have a New York Giants. Looks like a giant bottle cap. Would that be the same thing with the New York Giants, naming himself after the New York Giants, who are now the San Francisco Giants baseball team?
That's right. Yeah, because the San Francisco Giants were they go back to the 1800s, and so did the baseball Dodgers. I mean, they started playing baseball in the 1800s, and the football team started to play in the in the 1920s. And that bottle cap, by the way, that was a gift from my son a couple of years ago.
Well, that's definitely pretty cool. It's definitely a focal point here in the video that I'm seeing. So, so pretty neat, that's for sure. So where would you like to start on these great teams? Or,
well, being that I'm a Brooklyn native, why don't we start with the Brooklyn Dodgers of the All-American Conference? And they were not a terribly successful team. They only competed for 3 years, and they were actually the first entry in from the New York in the All-America Conference. They were originally owned by William Cox, who was once owner of the Philadelphia Phillies in Major League Baseball, but he was removed from Major League Baseball in 1943 because it was found that he was gambling on baseball while owning the Phillies. So he was barred from baseball. But there was a couple of years later, there was a startup football league. So he signed on and he was going to host football at Ebbets Field, and he named his team, of course, the Dodgers. And their first season, they did not have, they only won three games. They were 3-10-1. And you knew right away that they were going to struggle, because in their first season, they had three head coaches. They started the season with Dr. Mal Stevens. He was 1-4-1 in his six games. And depending on what you read in the papers, he was fired or he resigned. And in some places, it was reported as a resignation, because not only was he the head coach, he also owned 10% of the team. So technically, he couldn't be fired, but he resigned as head coach, but he retained his 10% interest in the team. So they had an interim coach for one game, Tom Scott. He was actually 1-0. He won his one game. Maybe they should have held on to him. But they had intended to hire Fred Linehan, but he turned down the job in the middle of the week. And there was a near revolt by the Dodger players. They were going to claim mistreatment, and some of them were threatening to jump over to the NFL. There was an emergency meeting held by the owner, Cox. And he ended up finding a coach who had no affiliation with the team at all. He got Cliff Battles, who was in the NFL. He was a star with the Redskins, and he ended up coaching the team for the remainder of the year. He finished 1-6, but they did hold on to him, and he also coached the team through 1947, where they also had a matching 3-10-1 record. And then after 1947, Cox sold the team. Battles was fired as coach, and they actually became owned by Branch Rickey, who also owned the baseball Dodgers. So he owned both teams playing in Ebbets Field that year. And they hired Carl Voiles as the head coach. And the team actually got worse. They finished the 1948 season 2-12. So Branch Rickey had had enough, and he folded up operations, and the Dodgers franchise was then absorbed into the All-America Conference Yankees organization. So the Yankees, sometimes you would see them in the newspapers referred to as the Brooklyn New York Yankees, or sometimes it was just the New York Yankees, but they were the New York Yankees and they had some Brooklyn players.
Okay, very, very interesting. You know, one thought that went through my head as soon as you said that Branch Rickey took over a struggling team. You know, mm-hmm. I'm thinking, man, if you could have grabbed Jackie Robinson, who was also a great football player at UCLA, because he's the one that hired signed Jackie Robinson as the first African American player in the majors, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. And, you know, so the Dodgers, they only had one truly notable player, and that was Glenn Dobbs. He was their tailback, quarterback, halfback, and also punter, and he was a defensive back. Believe it or not, in 1946, despite the Dodgers, you know, being a bad team, finishing 3-10-1, Glenn Dobbs was actually voted the most valuable player of the All-American Conference that year. He led the All-America Conference in passing attempts, in completions, in passing yards, in punt return yards, and he led the league in interceptions. He had 15 interceptions playing defense. He was a do-it-all. He was obviously proficient in all three phases of the game: offense, defense, special teams. He did it all. Punted, returned punts. He was picking off passes. He was throwing touchdown passes. He led the team in rushing and passing. And I guess, the Dodgers had a reputation of being a one-man team. It was Glenn Dobbs and 10 other guys. So, unfortunately, the next year, only 2 weeks into the season, Dobbs was traded away. And part of the reason, at least in the papers, they were describing it as the Dodgers trying to balance out their talent, trade their star player, and get back a couple of good players and kind of balance out the team. It didn't quite work out that way. And it was sort of a complicated three-team deal. It was between the Dodgers, the Los Angeles Dons, and the Chicago Rockets. So the way it went down was the Dodgers traded Dobbs to the Dons, and they got Angelo Bertelli, quarterback, in return. And then they traded Bertelli to the Chicago Rockets for Bob Hornschmeyer. And part of what played into that was the Dodgers were playing single wing football, and the Rockets were playing out of the T formation. And Bertelli was a T quarterback. They needed a T quarterback, which is why they got him from the Dons. And when the Dodgers traded Dobbs to the Dons, they actually weren't quite sure what to do with him, because Dobbs had never played in the T. He played single wing in college, and he played single wing with the Dodgers. So his first season, which was 12 games, they played a 14-game schedule. They tried him in a couple of spots. They played him at end. They played him at halfback. He played a little bit of quarterback, but he was a very tall player, and they actually, the Dons coaches, thought he was too tall to play the T formation quarterback under center, that his body type was better skilled to being the tailback, which would be a few yards back. It was kind of similar to a shotgun formation, what you would see today, where he was back from the center. But then his first full season with the Dons in 1948, he actually had a good year. He finished third in the league with 21 touchdown passes. He was behind Frankie Albert from the 49ers, led the league. I think he had 29. And then, of course, Otto Graham, I think, had 25 touchdown passes, and Dobbs had 21. So eventually he became a pretty decent T formation quarterback. But the other thing about that trade, where you see some conflicting stories in the papers, was that the day of the trade was announced, the New York Daily News, because clearly out of all those players, Dobbs was the best player, and the Dodgers gave up the best player. They gave him to the Dons. And the Daily News speculated that money was part of the deal, because the Dodgers were really struggling. The Yankees were doing pretty well, and the Giants, of course, were the established team. And the Dodgers were really struggling for attendance and for notice coverage in the press. Yeah, they were treated like the third-rate team in the league, or in the city. And the Dons were doing pretty well in Los Angeles. They were drawing some big crowds. And because the Rams had just moved to Los Angeles from Cleveland in 1946. So the Rams had no footprint. I mean, both teams were starting from scratch. And the Dons just got this star player. And excuse me. So the New York Daily News was speculating that cash is part of the deal. They got some money to help keep themselves solvent from the Dons. And the Los Angeles Times the next day said there was no money involved in the deal. And it was a day or two later, the New York Daily News said cash was part of the deal. So depending on maybe what city you're from and which paper you think is more credible, the Dodgers may or may not have gotten some sort of financial assistance from the Dons as part of that deal as well. But 2 years later, the Dodgers went after another ownership change, they dissolved and they became part of the All-America Conference Yankees.
Okay. Now, I would almost say I believe more of what the paper that said that they got some cash, because sit there and you think about the ownership that the Dons had. You know, you had some big players in Hollywood, including, yeah, you know, actors and singers and producers. And, you know, there's a lot of money being shoveled in.
Yeah,
that,
they
that,
did. So. And they were drawing big crowds for the 49ers. They had the West Coast rivalry, you know, and that's something that the Rams didn't have. I mean, they're the furthest team west, other than the Rams, was the Green Bay Packers.
Right. That's, yep. Yeah, that's right. They were the Los Angeles Rams, that when they moved from Cleveland, were the first NFL team west of the Mississippi, I believe.
Yeah, that was part of, you know, the AAFC, you know, part of their strategy when they were setting up the league was they noticed that the NFL was very regional. It was in the Northeast and the upper Midwest. You know, there was no team further south than the Redskins in Washington. So the All-America Conference put a team in Miami. And there was no team further west than Green Bay. So they put two teams on the West Coast, the Dons and the 49ers. Because, you know, after the war, air travel was becoming much more prevalent. You know, prior to that, you know, part of the reason the NFL was so regional was teams were still traveling by train. So it was very, very difficult to travel across the country by train.
Yeah, and you had a bunch of trained pilots at that point, too, when the war was over.
That's so, right. They had nothing to do. Some were playing football, and then some of them were flying football teams from the East Coast to the West Coast and back and forth.
Yeah, definitely an economy stir there and a technology stir, the war. Unfortunately, right. Has to go through a war to have those accomplishments happen. So very interesting.
Yeah. Okay. And, you know, the end of the war was a big part of the reason this league started, because all of a sudden there was a surplus of players. You know, the NFL, you know, kind of, you know, they did what they had to do to get through the war years. They were losing so many players. They shortened the schedule. They decreased roster size. You had teams merging. You had the Cleveland Rams suspended operations for 1 year. You know, you had owners, Dan Reeves of the Rams served in the war. George Halas served in the war. Wellington Mara from the Giants served in the war. You know, everybody did their part. But then when the war ended, you know, the NFL was getting players back, but there were a bunch of other guys who wanted to play football. So all of a sudden you have this other startup league coming up, and it was a very good league. They did very well for themselves.
And you had a lot of servicemen that played a lot of football at the different bases and camps that they were in and playing at a pretty high level, and including some of those gentlemen you just talked about. And a guy named Paul Brown was at a couple of those too, and took a few players from that and built a pretty good team there in Cleveland.
He sure did, and put them in the Hall of Fame. And I'll tell you what, while I was researching this, I found out this really interesting nugget that I had never known about before. But, you know, the Great Lakes Naval team that was coached by Brown and had Buddy Young and Marion Motley and Bill Willis, they were regarded as the best team in North America at that time. And one of the things that I read was, you know, they were traveling around the country. They were just not just beating everybody, but like they were just beating the heck. They were running up the score. They're blowing everybody out. They actually challenged the U.S. Naval Academy from Annapolis to a game. And supposedly Annapolis turned them down. They didn't want to play them.
I think I'm surprised they didn't challenge the Army Academy
team. Maybe they
team.
Should have. Maybe
yeah,
they should have.
Because, you know, those challenge years, West Point. That was so good. Some good teams with Army.
Yeah, those years, I mean, Army and Navy were 1 and 2.
Right. Well, they had a definite pick of the pool of talent. That's for sure.
Right. Right. Yeah. I don't. Maybe if they had beaten Navy, then maybe they would have played Army. I don't know. But that's that would have been something. That would have been something.
Yeah, definitely would have. Very interesting. Okay, so we have no more Dodgers. They are absorbed into the Yankees of New York.
Who were once the Dodgers? Once upon a time.
Yeah, there is. So it's so, okay. Now I guess that sort of segues us into the talking about the Yankees.
Yes. So Dan Topping was the owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers in the NFL. And he actually, believe it or not, in 1945, when the Brooklyn Tigers, you know, for 1944, the Dodgers changed their name to the Brooklyn Tigers. 1945, because of the man shortage in the war, they merged for one season with the Boston Yanks. During that merger, Dan Topping owner of the Brooklyn Tigers football team, purchased the baseball Yankees, planning ahead without telling anyone in the NFL that he wanted to get a foothold in Yankee Stadium. He had wanted to move the football Dodgers to Yankee Stadium, but Wellington Mara, Tim Mara, Wellington's father, kept blocking it. He owned territorial rights. And that goes back to the very first New York Yankees of the very first American Football League in 1926. The NFL kind of treated Brooklyn as being a separate market than New York. And in this case, you know, New York meaning Manhattan and also the Bronx, because Yankee Stadium and the Polo Grounds, if you've never seen an aerial photo, there's a bunch of them on Google. You can do a Google image search. They were in walking distance from one another, right across the Harlem River. So even though Yankee Stadium was the Bronx and the Polo Grounds was Manhattan, I mean, that you could see one stadium from the other. You could walk right across the bridge from one to the other. So the NFL treated that as New York football giants territory, and Brooklyn was something different. So you could have a team in Brooklyn and a team in New York. So Dan Topping was thinking, well, the NFL won't let me move to Yankee Stadium, but I can, if I can get be a part of this startup league, I can get into Yankee Stadium, which, by the way, was how the very first American Football League started, when C.C. Pyle wanted to start up the team with Red Grange. They first petitioned for entry into the NFL. The NFL denied it. So C.C. Pyle started that American Football League just so he could get Red Grange into Yankee Stadium. So here you are, you know, 20 years later, it's all very, something quite similar happening again. You have a startup league with an owner trying to get his football team into Yankee Stadium. So once that was announced in December 1945, that just started a whole firestorm in the NFL. The owners are very upset that they were losing a charter franchise, because originally the Brooklyn Dodgers were the Dayton Triangles, jumping leagues. Elmer Layden, who was the commissioner of the NFL, again, depending on which newspaper you read and who you believe, either his contract was not renewed, it may or may not have been expired in January 1946. I've also read an article or two saying that Elmer Layden resigned, but the NFL owners were very unhappy that the Brooklyn Tigers were jumping leagues to the All-America Conference, and they wanted a stronger owner who could get involved and, you know, get down and dirty with this impending war between two leagues, which is what was going to end up happening with. Every time there's two leagues, player salaries go up because they're bidding on the same talent and they're competing for star players. So Elmer Layden was replaced by Bert Bell. And Bert Bell's first order of business, which we were just alluding to a minute or two ago, was negotiating the relocation of the Rams from Cleveland to Los Angeles, because the NFL was panicking. Oh my God, they have two teams on the West Coast. We don't have anybody out West. So they shipped the Rams, who had just won the NFL title in 1945. They put them in Los Angeles to compete with the Dons.
Yeah, we've had Bert Bell's son, Upton Bell, on. He's a good friend of the program, and we've consulted with him on some other things. And Upton talked quite a bit about that. Of course, he was quite young when that all happened, but he might not even have been born at that point. Well, he had to have been born, but he's quite young. But he told us how his father not only had that issue, he had the betting scandal right before the NFL championship game
that
year.
Right.
The moves to the West Coast. He had a lot of things going on, and really did a fine job under all the circumstances
So he was thrown right into the fire. It wasn't easy.
Yeah. So I think some of the things that maybe Layden either stepped down or was dismissed was probably some of that stuff was brewing long before that. And you know, somebody was catching wind of it, and somebody had to do something about it. Ended up being Bert Bell.
Yeah. They were a couple of the things that I read said Elmer Layden wasn't a bad commissioner. He was just too nice of a guy, you know, for that kind of with a rival league. He just wasn't strong enough to get involved in some of that stuff.
Yeah, he was probably another one of those guys, you know, because of course Elmer Layden was one of the four horsemen of Notre Dame.
Yep.
You know, and we know how the NFL like to use those big names to have as their head, you know, Jim Thorpe.
And the All-America Conference countered with Jim Crowley.
Right. That's right. So we have, you know, commissioners are changing, you know, the Dodgers are switching leagues and you know, we're sort of, things are becoming quite tranquil now that the AAFC is in bed.
No, not at all.
No, okay.
So the Yankees, you know, wanted to make a splash. So for their head coach, they hired Ray Flaherty, who was a star player with the Giants. He was the first NFL player to have his number retired, number one by the Giants. And he won two NFL titles coaching the Washington Redskins. So he was the Yankees coach for their first 2.5 seasons. And they had some very good marquee players, some very familiar names. Clarence Ace Parker was their tailback in 1946. He was a star player with the Brooklyn Dodgers. Frank Bruiser Kennard, who was a star lineman. He's in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. He was a lineman with the original Brooklyn Dodgers. They had Frank Sinkwich, was a halfback. He played the first couple of years with the Yankees. They had Pete Layden at tackle, and they had Speck Sanders at their tailback. He was probably their most notable player their first couple of years. And he was actually a 28-year-old rookie, you know, like a lot of the names I mentioned, like Ace Parker, these players, and Frank Sinkwich, they had their careers interrupted by World War II. Speck Sanders entered professional football as a 28-year-old rookie because he had been in the Navy during World War II. He led the All-America Conference in 1946 and 1947 in rushing yards, in rushing touchdowns. He was all-pro twice. He led the Yankees in passing and punting, but he missed a chunk of the 1948 season. He was having some knee problems, and that also involved a coaching change. The Yankees were the best team in the East. They won the Eastern Division in 1946 and 1947. And they played the Cleveland Browns in the championship games both years. The first year, they gave the Browns, the game was played in Cleveland. They gave the Browns a very, very tough game. They almost beat them. It took a last minute comeback by Otto Graham, and they beat the Yankees 14-9. The Yankees were winning that game 9-7 late in the fourth quarter. And then the 47, they played the game in New York at Yankee Stadium, but the Yankees lost that one 14-3. So 1949, Speck Sanders took the year off to rehab his knees. And because he was, you know, not only their best tailback, he was also their punter. The Yankees needed a punter. So who did they sign to punt for them? Tom Landry. So wow. They signed him to punt the football, and they got a whole lot more. He was a safety. And again, he was another, I don't know his exact age, but again, he was like in his late 20s because he had served in the Army Air Corps during World War II. And he was, you know, just a brilliant mind. And for that year, 1949, when they had been merged with the Dodgers, the Yankees had a better year. There were no divisions that year in the All-American Conference. It was one league stacked top to bottom. The top four teams made the playoffs. The Yankees finished third, so they played a playoff game at San Francisco against the 49ers, who were second, but they lost to the 49ers 17-7. But all of the newspapers, particularly the ones in San Francisco, because they had the writers there at the game, talked about what an excellent punting exhibition it was. Tom Landry in that game punted 10 times, averaging 55 yards a punt.
Wow.
Including he had a 73 yarder in that game.
Jeez, that's good in any era when you can kick a ball that far consistently.
Yeah, that's right.
Hmm.
So the couple of interesting things about the Yankees, you know, they were one of the few teams, they never beat the Browns, but they usually managed to play the Browns pretty tough. And, you know, aside from the championship game in 46 that they, you know, lost 14-9, they Otto Graham won the game late for them. They played them at Yankee Stadium that year. It was a 7-0 win for the Browns. They played them tough in Cleveland in 47. And then at Yankee Stadium late in 1947, the one time they didn't lose to the Browns, they tied them 28-28. And the Yankees had led that game 28-7 at halftime. But the Browns, again, Otto Graham, automatic Otto, had a led a big comeback in the second half and they tied. But the Yankees still consider that to be a seminal moment for them that, you know, they're all right, we can go toe-to-toe with the Browns. We're going to get them this year. But the notable thing about that 47 season, and you were mentioning the gambling scandal in 1946. All right. So for the 1946 championship game, the Giants were hosting the Bears. And late in the week leading up to the game, there was a gambling scandal, which the Giants and the NFL found out about. It was Saturday afternoon. It was Merle Haps and Frankie Philchok were involved with a known member of the mob, and he was asking them to shave points. So, and it was front page headlines on Sunday morning. It was on all the radio stations. There was no TV in 1946. And, you know, the Bears won the title. Merle Haps was banned from football forever. Frankie Philchok wasn't, but he ended up playing a number of years in Canada and he played really well. And then in the 50s, he came back and he played one part of a season with the Chicago Cardinals. He was found not guilty for the gambling, but because he knew of it and didn't report it right away, he was looked on unfavorably. And this was a black eye, not only for the NFL, but also for the Giants. And with the ascendancy of this startup league and the Yankees having a good team and playing well against the Browns in the championship game, all of a sudden, football fans in New York started looking across the Harlem River to Yankee Stadium. And the next year, if you go through all the New York papers, the Yankees are given not only equal, but sometimes more favorable coverage than the Giants did. And the Giants, you know, because they lost Philchok, they took a downturn. They didn't have a good year in 47. On November 9th, when the Yankees were hosting the San Francisco 49ers at Yankee Stadium, the Giants were also playing a home game against the Eagles. The Yankees outdrew the Giants. The Yankees drew a little over 37,000. The Giants had 29. That was the first time since 1926 with the CC Pyle and Red Grange Yankees in the first AFL that the Giants were outdrawn on a home date. And that was treated as a big deal. It was mentioned in every local New York newspaper. And 2 weeks later, when the Yankees hosted the Cleveland Browns at Yankee Stadium, they drew over 70,000 people. Yankee Stadium was standing room only. That was the biggest crowd in New York since the Giants hosted Red Grange with the Bears in 1925, where they had an estimated crowd of 73,000. And that was the headline of every New York paper the next day. It wasn't that the Yankees tied the Browns. It was that the Yankees drew 70,000 people into Yankee Stadium and right across the river. The Giants were, by the way, hosting the Packers, who the Packers are a marquee team. You know, the Giants had played them in the NFL championship game in 1944. They drew an okay crowd of 27,000. It was just short of 28. But clearly, New York was far more interested in the Yankees. And the average attendance that year, the Yankees outdrew the Giants by a pretty decent margin. The Yankees averaged 37.8 that year. The Giants had just under 32. They were 31.6.
And I'm just picturing in my mind somewhere in the Chicago area, there's Arch Ward just rubbing his palms together saying, oh, I knew we could get the NFL. He probably thought he had him licked then.
Of course, the Rockets weren't having that kind of success against the Bears and the Cardinals, but, you know, he was doing pretty good in New York. And, you know, 1948, you know, the Yankees, that was the one year they had a losing record. They were 6-8. The Giants were mediocre. And the attendance kind of reflected that. The Yankees had just over 23,000, and the Yankees drew 23,001. The Giants drew 23,002. So that's a push. That's a push. Hmm. And then 1949, where you had the merged Yankees and Dodgers team, they did outdraw the Giants a couple of times that year. When they hosted the Browns, the Yankees pulled in 48,000. And that date, the Giants were playing the Detroit Lions. They had 21,000. But again, the end-of-year average, Yankees were 22-6. The Giants were 23-9. So, you know, they just squeaked by a hair. But, you know, the real problem was that this competition that the Giants were involved in, it was driving up player salaries. And, you know, there was no TV money. There was no lucrative contracts. You know, NFL and All-America Conference teams made their hay by drawing at the gate. That's why attendance was so crucial. You know, the more people you had at the game, I mean, that's your revenue. So a lot of people don't know this, but in the late, I don't know what year, I don't know if it was 49 or 48, but the Giants were in such dire straits after the betting scandal that they had to take out a loan to remain solvent. And they were actually still, I don't know the exact number, I don't know the dollar amount, but they were still paying off that loan in the 1980s just to keep the team afloat. That's right. The Yankees nearly drew them into bankruptcy.
Huh. Well, that's surprising with the Mara family, because didn't they own like a bunch of racetracks, horse racing tracks?
Not at that time. That was in the 1920s. He, Tim Mara, he didn't own any tracks, but he owned a booth. He had a little piece of Saratoga. You know, he started out as a bookmaker, but it was by the early 30s he had gotten out of that, and they were strictly into football by then.
Okay, so yeah, his money was pretty much wrapped in, his only business at that point was the Giants then. Okay.
Yeah, and he also owned some coal fields, but you know, he sold that stuff off during the Depression, and he put his sole focus into the Giants by then.
And so those were just his side gigs that he would get rid of, and
right, the because football wasn't making any money, so he needed to, you know. In the modern times, you would say you need to diversify your portfolio.
There you go.
Right. But, you know, the Great Depression took care of most of that. There was very little diversity. Just do what you can, you know, scrape and save and do what you have to do to get by.
Okay. Well, that explains a lot then.
Yeah.
So, very interesting.
Yeah. So at the end of the All-America Conference after the 1949 season, what happened was, you know, you had the Browns and the 49ers, of course, were admitted into the NFL. Also, the original Baltimore Colts, who were a very poorly run franchise. They were originally the Miami Seahawks, and they were only going to last 1 year in the NFL. What became of the Yankees is Dan Topping sold his interests to Ted Collins of the Boston Yanks. So the Boston Yanks were not doing well in Boston. And again, they were another team that was itching to get into Yankee Stadium. That's why he named his team in Boston the Yanks, because he was just obsessed with Yankee Stadium. So Dan Topping, when the All-American Conference was folding, he sold his interest in the football Yankees to Dan Topping, who in 1949 had moved his team from Boston to New York. But they shared the Polo Grounds with the Giants. And because there was a team in New York called the Yankees, he couldn't call his team the Yanks. So for that 1 year, his team was called the New York Bulldogs.
Okay.
In 1950, with the Yankees dissolved, and he, you know, taking what was left of the Yankees franchise, jumped across the river into Yankee Stadium, where he always wanted to be, and gave his team their original name back. They were the New York Yanks. So Bert Bell said because of the territorial rights in New York, what they would do is with the Yankees players, there would be a draft between the Giants and the Yanks. They would flip a coin to see who picks first, and they would each have 10 picks so they could take the 20 best players from the Yankees roster. So the New York Yanks won the coin toss, and they took Buddy Young. who was a very, you know, one of their marquee players after Spec Sanders left. He was an excellent back. He was, he wasn't the first African-American player in the All-America Conference, but he was the most notable one in New York. You know, the Giants had Emlyn Tennell, but he wanted a famous Yankees player playing in Yankee Stadium to help draw fans. And the Giants, with Steve Owen coaching the team, of course, went defense first, and he picked Arnie Weinmeister, who was a defensive tackle. And, you know, then the Giants got Tom Landry and Harmon Rowe and Otto Schnellbacher. All the good players that they got from the Yankees played defense. And those, you know, those three players, Rowe, Schnellbacher, and Landry, helped form the umbrella defense with Emlyn Tennell, which they used to beat the Cleveland Browns the first time they played them in 1950.
Hmm. All right. They knew a little bit about the Browns tactics at that point, I would think.
They sure did. And, hey, you know, having Tom Landry on the team helped a lot because he had played against Otto Graham and the Browns offense and, you know, the T formation. You know, the Bears in the 1940 championship game, you know, made the T formation well known. And then the Eagles were one of the first teams to adopt it after that. But what Paul Brown was doing with it, with, you know, Otto Graham and Max Speedy. And I mean, it was just flash forward, you know, they were 20 years ahead of their time with the timing passes and the draw plays and the out and the flat, you know, all the stuff that Bill Walsh did with the 49ers in the 80s directly came from Paul Brown and what he was doing in the 40s and the 50s.
Yeah, of course, having a beast like Marion Motley to carry the ball, too.
That's right. You throw the ball on the flats to Dub Jones and then, you know, Marion Motley up the middle and nobody wanted to take that guy head on.
Yeah.
He was like Bronco Nagurski.
Yeah. A large man, from what I understand. Yeah, that's
huge,
for sure.
Man. It was like giving the ball to a guard.
And I think in the AFC, he wore a number like a guard, too. Was he like number 76 or something, too?
Right.
It was an odd number like that.
Was 60 because we talked about the numbering system. The American Conference had a very, very different numbering system where the play numbers were by position.
Right. Okay.
And the NFL never had one until it was after the merger. I think it was 52.
Yep.
They had the first numbering system, which is, you know, it was very close to what we see. You know, it's been refined and modified a couple of times, but that was basically, you know, what we've come to know, you know, where quarterbacks would be, you know, 1 to 19, because Otto Graham switched from 60 to 14 and Marion Motley wore 32.
Yes.
After he wore his big number.
The original 32 for the Browns.
That's right.
Or at least
right.
The before original Jim Brown, good running back Marion 32. I mean, there may have been a 32 before that, but not as good as those two were running the ball, for sure.
That's right.
So, hey, that is some great stuff, and you know, appreciate that. Now, what do you have anything that we can see that you're working on, either at Big Blue Interactive or Gridiron Uniform Database?
Well, I'm still working on my article for the 90 Giants for Big Blue Interactive. It's been taking me longer than I expected, but I've had a lot of stuff going on, and one of which has now been, you know, we teased it a couple of times here for the Gridiron Uniform Database about this big reveal that was coming. We've been introducing the Canadian Football League. We've been working, Bill and Tim and I, doing a lot of research, going through newspapers north of the border and digging up what we can on the Canadian version of football with 110-yard field and 12 players per side. And you can score one. You can win a game 1-0 in Canada, believe it or not, like a hockey game.
Right, with the
and
Rouge.
Playoff games can end in ties in Canada. And it's just this whole interesting world. And the uniforms are cool, too. And one thing that you'll see on the Gridiron Uniform Database, you'll know that all of our teams, whether they be NFL, All-America Conference, the different AFLs, you know, every team is shown with every jersey is shown with the number 11. That's not the case in the CFL database because, as Bill pointed out, he did a really nice blog when he introduced it. For some reason in Canada, they really preferred big numbers. Everything is double player 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. And he said, you know, we're just looking and looking, and we couldn't find players who wore number 11 or numbers in the teens or single digits. Everybody wore these big numbers. Everybody 55 and 88. And so that's what ended up on the website. So you're going to see a variety of numbers and different combinations. And so it's, so everything about it is a little bit, it's a little bit different.
Well, you guys are hitting it just in time, as now the CFL season looks like it's going to be a full go here.
It is.
We've been talking quite a bit about it.
A lot of really good feedback. Fans seem to be really into it. We've gotten some notes in the forum, and we've also been getting direct messages. People are really, you know, I was a little surprised. I, you know, in my naivety, I didn't realize that the CFL had as big of a following as it does. And apparently, you know, there's been a lot of excitement over it. And, you know, what we have right now is from the mid 40s up through 1959. We've done a lot of research. Bill is just catching up with some of the graphics, and I believe his plan is to display it in 5-year increments. So probably pretty soon, in the next couple of weeks, you're going to see 1960 through 1964 up. And then once the CFL season gets rolling, you'll probably get the rest of the 60s in there. So we're, you know, the research is always going on. We always have our noses in the newspapers, and we're dragging up scraps wherever we can find them. It's, and as you get closer in time, the photographs become more plentiful. But, you know, some of the Canadian provinces, it's been hard to find some of the newspapers, but we're doing pretty good. And incrementally, just keep checking the site every couple of weeks, and you're going to start seeing a lot more CFL up there.
Well, that's we've been talking a lot about the CFL on Pigskin Dispatch too lately. We've had you know, a couple of our friends that are authors. R.C. Christensen wrote the book Border Boys, which is, you know, that's a great book. It has a lot of CFL and a lot of Canadian American crossover there.
Yeah. It's been fun, you know, going through the newspapers in the 1950s. You know, I saw Ali Sherman, who was a coach with the Giants. He was coaching the Winnipeg Blue Bombers, and so did Bud Grant from the Vikings. He was a Winnipeg head coach. And Frankie Filchak, you know, from the Redskins and the Giants, he played in Canada after the gambling scandal. So there are quite a few, you know, players who went from the NFL to Canada and vice versa. So it's been really, really interesting. And, you know, aside from enjoying this and just having fun doing it, I'm always learning something, and I love to learn new things. And it's been very, very, very fascinating and rewarding. I'm really learning a lot, and I'm enjoying it.
Yeah. It brings back a lot of memories for me, because I live, you know, right on Lake Erie. So right across the lake from us, you know, only 20 miles away from Erie is London, Ontario. And they would put a lot of CFL games on, you know, before, in the days before cable TV. And we could get the reception quite often, you know, because there's nothing on the lake really. So reception would come right across. And you know, the summer evenings, you know, July and August, we could watch some football games back in you know, the 70s and 80s. And so I got to become accustomed to the Canadian game a little bit back when I was a kid.
I used to watch some CFL in the 80s. They used to have it on ESPN. And I remember Vince Ferragamo, when he played in the Super Bowl with the Rams, left the NFL and he played with the Montreal Alouettes for a year. And you know, so in the, you know, the United States, you know, ESPN was showing Montreal games. From what I remember, they actually didn't have a very good year. But early on, there was a lot of buzz, and people wanted to see Vince Ferragamo playing in Montreal. So, and you know, for a few years, I was watching some CFL.
And you know, we'll have a lot of Division II teams right around here. And actually, school I graduated from my hometown, Edinburgh University, we have our former quarterback is Trevor Harris, who's the starting quarterback last year, and I think he will be this year too for the Edmonton Elks. So there's some connections in our area too with the CFL.
Formerly the Eskimos.
Formerly the Eskimos. He was an Eskimo.
Who gave us Warren Moon?
Right. So we have a lot of interest in this area, trying to follow some of those guys that we know so well from our area that made the jump up to CFL as one of the 12 or 13 Americans they're allowed to have on each roster. I don't know what the number is. They change it all the time, and they're arguing about it. So who knows what's going to happen? So, well, Larry, I appreciate you coming on and sharing this you know, great bit of history with the All-America Football Conference, the Dodgers, the Yankees, and everything in between, including the projects you have going on at the Gridiron Uniform Database with the CFL uniform. So, Larry Schmidt, thank you very much once again for joining us.
thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure. I always enjoy, you know, sharing everything that I learn. I love, you know, I love doing the research, and you give me a venue to just put it out there.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, it's found right here on the Sports History Network.